Okay, welcome all. I'm going to mute all. As usual, you will have the ability to unmute yourself. Please feel free to do so. If you have a question or comment, please remute yourself afterwards, so that we keep background noise to a minimum. And welcome all. If we have any new people with us tonight, if you want to join the PC user group, the link is in the chat window, or you can go to our website. There's a link at the top for join or renew. And but we do welcome guests at any time through all of our meetings. So we have big agenda tonight. So without any further notice, I will kick it over to Alan to lead us through tonight's deck. Alan, take it away. And start by unmuting yourself. None of us are on the ball tonight.
There we go. Thanks, Chris. Okay, so just before we get going, another note, anybody who's new here tonight, if you caught the pre-meeting conversation, we're always interested to find out how people know about us. So if you're new to the Q&A tonight, just drop something in the chat and tell us where you found out about us. Okay, as Chris said, we've got a whole pile of stuff tonight. I think it's going to be quite interesting. I'm going to start off with a follow-up on encryption. And if you remember, I was talking about this program called Encrypt on Click, which is a freeware open source product. And Bill asked, how quickly does it encrypt? And Elizabeth said, does it work with large files? Because my demo was a very small file. So I said I would do some testing, and here are the results. So if I take one 4 megabyte JPEG and encrypt it and then decrypt it, it's pretty much instant. It happened so fast I couldn't even think about timing it. I created a folder that had 5 JPEGs with 18 meg. That encrypted in 3 seconds and decrypted in 2 seconds. And I had an MPEG video which was half a gigabyte. So now we're getting to some time taken. It took about 40 seconds to encrypt that half a gigabyte file, but it decrypts in less than half that time, 14 seconds. And then finally, I had a video which was 2.5 gig. It took a little more than 3 minutes to encrypt, and just over a minute and a quarter, I guess, to decrypt. So those are the kind of times that you get on this freeware program. And if that is of interest to you, it's quite a neat little product. The other thing we talked about was having a folder with a bunch of files in it. So here I've taken this folder called Foxes. I've encrypted the folder. I encrypted the file names within the folder. So here are the 3 files inside this encrypted container. And I wanted to see if I could just decrypt one of them. So I selected this one right here and asked Encrypt on Click to encrypt on declick or decrypt on click. And sure enough, it leaves the 2 here encrypted and decrypts the one that I selected. So it's actually a pretty flexible type program, and it's free, so try it out. If it doesn't work the way you like, then throw it away, I guess. Find something else. Okay, there we go. So let's move along, and Chris has got some stuff about laptop batteries.
Yeah, so this dates back quite a bit, a couple of years. You'll see some of the screenshots that I have dates in them that go back quite a bit. And I started on this and did a bunch of slides, and then I thought, it really isn't all that interesting or applicable to majority of the people. But then I was looking through it again just recently, and I thought, well, it might actually be applicable to a bunch of people. So I decided to revise it and finish it off. So this is talking about a problem I was having with battery life on a laptop, and it was specifically a Microsoft Surface Book 2. And the battery was draining even when it was completely turned off, and that's not in sleep mode or hibernation or anything like that. It was actually done a complete shutdown, and it would drain the battery. And overnight, I could go from full charge to completely drained in just, you know, that sort of number of hours. But the battery seemed to be operating normally, in that if I was just operating it on battery, it would last, you know, the typical 6 7 hours without any problem at all. So it wasn't extraordinarily short or long. And I will say on this that your mileage may vary on this item. There are a lot of variables that come into play on it. And the last note at the bottom of the slide, I'm not an expert when it comes to battery use in Windows, but this is just something that I came across. Next. So in Windows, you can actually get a battery report done. So they say you should run command prompt as an administrator. It will actually function without it being an administrator. I'm just not sure if it maybe doesn't collect as much information or what. So I do recommend you you can click the start button, type in CMD, and in the results at the top, you'll have command prompt. And then right-click it and choose run as administrator. Later versions of Windows, you don't even have to do that. There will be a right-hand panel that will list the command prompt, and one of the options there will be to run as administrator. So when it opens, you type in power CFG space and then hyphen battery report, and it will output a report to the default directory, which typically if you're running a command prompt as administrator, it actually starts in the Windows System 32 directory. So the battery report will be there, and it tells you it's battery-report.html. So it's an HTML file, and you can end up just double-clicking it to open it up in your default browser. Next. So if we look at battery-report.html, first off, it can be a really large file in some circumstances. I've had some circumstances where battery report is really small, but I've had it over a megabyte in size. It'll load into the browser, and then it is divided into different sections. Next. So at the top, you have some boilerplate information. So it tells you your computer name and the operating system and things like that. And then for me, I had connected standby, and it was listed as supported. And we'll come back to that afterwards. Next. Then it gives you a report on your battery or batteries. In the case of Surface Book 2, there's two batteries in it. And it gives you a little bit of information about it. And one of the things I found interesting on this is that the batteries are in pretty good shape. So the design capacity being 17902 and the full charge capacity being 15187. So basically it lost about 15% capacity over 5 years, which is not too bad. And that was on battery one. So battery two was pretty much about the same thing. About 15% capacity lost over 5 years. So that's pretty good. Next. Then you get into recent usage, and this is where it started getting really curious. So you can see at the top, we started at 1621, and we had 89% battery life at that point in time. Next. If we look 7.75 hours later, it was down to 40%. Now that was, I think it was on the entire time, but I'm not 100% sure on that. Next. And then 4%, it was down to 4% 5 hours later. And in this case, it definitely was off during that period of time. And it went from 40% down to 4% in 5 hours with the computer turned off. Next. So, yeah, overall, I guess it was turned off through that whole thing from at the top. So, because I say I lost 85% in under 13 hours with the computer turned off. So that was really bizarre. And I look in it, and you can see all kinds of entries in there where it says active. And so it was becoming active every 30 to 90 seconds, even though the computer was turned off. Next. And then I plugged it in, and 2 hours later, it was back to 72%. So it's sort of normal on its charge cycle that it very quickly got charged up again. Next. So I was curious as to what this connected standby was all about in there and why it was actually becoming active. So I asked ChatGPT if connected standby uses battery even if the computer is turned off. Next. And sure enough, it comes back, and it's a little bit of wishy-washy stuff, but it does note that that connected standby is a means of power saving, but it allows your computer to remain connected to the internet and receive notifications, emails potentially, and various things like that. even when the device appears to be in a sleep or off state. So that was kind of interesting. The reason why Microsoft developed this connected standby was so that you have this responsive experience, you know, instant on capabilities, more like a phone. So they define it as being a low power state where certain background tasks and applications continue to run even if your computer is turned off. Very bizarre. It's supposed to be very power efficient, but in my case, it wasn't. They say it shouldn't significantly drain the battery when the computer is off or in standby. But then they get into the wishy-washy parts of power usage varies depending on factors such as hardware design, system settings, apps running in the background, and things like that. So they said that you can check the device documentation or settings on how connected standby is implemented on that particular computer and software configuration. And I have never seen that documented. So I think this idea of check the docs is not going to be all that helpful. Next. So then I went looking for some more information on what is modern standby or connected standby. They actually use those terms somewhat interchangeably at Microsoft. And they say there that it enables the system to stay connected to the network while in a low power mode. And it looked like the Surface, when you turn it off, it actually goes into a low power mode, which is kind of curious. Next. And so if you want to know if your laptop computer or your portable computer is using connected standby, look in the battery report at the top, and it says connected standby, whether it's supported or not. And I'm just presuming that if it's supported, it ends up being used, period. Now, if you don't want that, next, you can actually disable connected standby. So to do so, you click start, type in regedit, and in the results pane, you'll get registry editor. And so you run it. You'll get an elevation prompt to run as administrator. Navigate in the left-hand pane to HK local machine system current control set control power, and then double-click on a value there that you'll see called CS enable for connected standby, and change the value data to zero. On my Surface Book, there was no value CS enabled, but I could create it. So you create it by right-clicking, choosing a new DWORD 32-bit value, and then setting it to zero. And then I rebooted, and the Surface was no longer using connected standby, and it no longer was draining the battery, even though the computer was turned off. So really kind of interesting. So the warning at the bottom, take it to heart before you make changes to the registry. Pretty good idea to make sure you have a good backup. In case you change something that is not correct, and it has the potential that Windows can definitely become non-bootable if you change things willy-nilly in the registry. But if you go to that specific place in the registry, it is pretty safe. But as always, if you're modifying the registry, good idea to have a backup.
And Tom just notes that image backups are good, or you could create a system restore point, or you could actually back up the registry.
Yeah, the problem with backing up the registry or system restore point can be it can get really difficult. If you get to a state where Windows won't even boot, it gets more difficult and more consuming to try and restore things without doing a complete image restore. It is possible, but it just gets more difficult. And that's it for that. So hopefully, if people are having problems with the battery draining on a portable device, even when the computer is turned off, check out to see whether connected standby is enabled. And if you disable it, does it fix the problem for you? And if anybody has experience with that after the fact, it'd be kind of cool if you could report at a future Q&A if it turned out to be solving a problem that you had. And that's all I have on connected standby.
Thanks, Chris. And some of us are going to check that out, even though we don't think we have a problem. So,
yeah, it's very odd.
Huh. Yeah. Well, they say it shouldn't drain your battery, not that it won't.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's not supposed to. Yeah, right. Even Microsoft didn't implement it very well on the Microsoft Surface Book 2. So.
Well, it looks like you probably have an app like Mail or maybe a browser or something that's accessing every couple of minutes something to see, is there more stuff for me?
And well, it could be, but why, you know, my puzzlement on it was, if I do a shutdown, you know, it should be shutting down all apps and then shutting down Windows, and so there shouldn't be any apps running, but obviously something weird is happening there.
Microsoft knows best. Okay, thanks, Chris. So moving along, we're going to talk about shares and smart applications. And it's been a while since we've had any Android apps, so we have a few tonight. I just remind you that if you have any programs that you really like, for Android in particular, smartphones or tablets, or even if you've got programs that we haven't talked about that you use on your PC, we're always interested to hear about them. People like to find out new things, so if you have an application that you'd like to share, just let us know as usual, and we'll put it on the agenda. So this came about because Stuart Bruce sent in a share, and this is about the International Space Station. And apparently NASA has launched a new app for both Android and the dark side, the iPhone, that lets you locate the International Space Station. And Stuart notes that you never know where it's going to be, so this is quite useful. And it basically helps you track the path of the station so you can see where it is at any given time. And even if it's on the other side of the universe or the world, this app is going to be able to find it. So if you're interested in following the trials and tribulations of the International Space Station, there is an app for your phone or your tablet that will find that for you. Okay, the second one is one I've been using, which is a
Oh, Alan's frozen.
Oh, while he's frozen. there one other way to track stuff in the sky is a PC application called Stellarium, which will allow you to track the ISS and other satellites as well as everything else in the universe and show that on your PC screen, either currently or at any arbitrary time.
I think we're getting some sound through from Android Alan.
Devices.
Oh, is he gone? He's gone. I think he'll be connecting back, so we'll give him, there he is. You're back, Alan, but you're muted.
Looks like jagged movement.
Oh, he's saying I'm going to have to make him a, oh no, he's still co-host, so that's fine. So Alan, you should be good to share.
Okay, I was sharing my screen and turned on my mic, so we should be back in business.
Yes, we are.
I don't know what happened there. It just everything disappeared. Okay, I was talking about this thing where you can map keys, and what you can do is you can basically set up a key to do a number of different things, because you can tell it what to do if you do a single press or a double press or a long press. And one of the neat things is whatever the device is, the program figures out what buttons are available right now. And for example, I use this for a Google or a streaming TV service. I'm using the NVIDIA TV Shield device. It's an Android box. And it has a remote control, which you can see in the picture here. And out of the box, it has a special button which is dedicated to Netflix. So if you press this button and you have a Netflix subscription, then it loads Netflix for you. So you don't have to press, you know, 20 buttons to scroll up and down menus to find and load Netflix. Well, that's fine if you have a Netflix subscription, but I don't have a Netflix anymore. I'm using BritBox. So I was basically able, using this button mapper program, to map the Netflix button, the special button, using a long press to call up BritBox. which is a really handy thing to be able to do. So if anybody wants to map buttons on Android devices to do other things than they're supposed to do, then there's an app that will help you do that. Okay, the second app I have is a shutdown program. And this all came about because my previous phone had a tiny little power button which was kind of recessed in the side of the phone, and it was incredibly difficult to press. And this was when I was playing around with custom ROMs, and I was always trying to basically restart the program or start it in the default mode so I could play around with the routing system. So I found this program called Shutdown, which is basically a software application. And when you get this red button, this guy right here in the middle of the screen, you get the red button on your actual display. And when you press that, it pops up the same power menu that you would get had you pressed the power button on the side, the actual hardware power button on the side of the phone typically. So I actually find this much more convenient than pressing the power button. I just hit this key and then I can power off by clicking on the power off button. So there's a few apps for you. And again, if you have any similar ones that you'd like to share with us, let us know. Okay, next up we have an item from Wayne, and Chris is going to talk about this.
Yeah, so Wayne was kind enough to send in the information on this, which it really ticked me off that this happened. But KC Softwares has two totally free and quite useful programs, Sumo and Dumo, so Software Update Monitor and Driver Update Monitor. And the reason why I was so enamored by these particular programs is that I do give presentations on security. And one of the things about security is vulnerability management. And so there used to be a couple of other programs around that did really good vulnerability management, and they went away, went commercial, and then they dropped the free consumer version of the program. And so I found this one KC Softwares had, in particular Software Update Monitor, which did a pretty good job of telling you if any of the programs on your computer had newer versions available. Not really vulnerability management. It was strictly speaking update manager. So you know that something was newer, but not necessarily that it fixed bugs that were security related. Next. So on KC Software's website right now, it says termination notice, and that as of the end of October of this year, KC Software is no more. And so they had no suggestions for replacements for it or other things that you could go for. It was just gone. Next.
And just to note, Chris, that it really has gone. If you try and run the program, nothing happens because there's no server to go and get updates from.
Yeah, that's the problem. The way it worked was that it would scan your system and then compare it to a list at KC Software's website, say, which knew what the latest version was of all of the programs that you run. So without that back end, it can't do anything. So I went off and I looked at Alternatives too. And so this is a website. You can go in, you can plug in any program, and it will come up with other programs that they think are, you know, the same sort of programs or are designed to do the same thing. So I looked for Alternative to Personal Software Inspector, which was actually a very good vulnerability manager, not an update manager, that went away a number of years ago. It was a great program. I really liked it for keeping all of my software up to date from a security point of view. Next. And it came up with a number of them. So going down the list, there was Patch My PC, and it's free, and it had over 300 applications that it monitors. Now, 300 applications in the Windows world is pretty small. Now, of course, it's going to be covering the major ones, but I wanted something that covered more than 300 applications, ideally. I looked at it also offered Slim Drivers, and it only updates drivers, so I wasn't interested in that. There was Update Manager, which listed itself as a Linux Mint Update Manager, which is no use to me. They have Rucksack, which was a free software package manager for Windows. Well, I wasn't interested in a package manager. I just want something that'll tell me if my software needs to be updated. They had Software Villa, and malware bytes on my computer blocked the website due to potentially unwanted program, so I didn't look any further on that. They had 9.8 Updater, and they wanted US $10 and up per year for that, so I passed on that. And they came up with Glarisoft Software Update, and that actually looked promising. So I went to it. Next. And so on their website, they show that, yes, indeed, you can pay money and you get something extra for it. But what do you get on the free? So you get check for updates. Okay, that's fine. Automatic software update, manual. So if you are willing to pay money, you can get it automated where it will do the upgrades for you. And quality software recommendations, I don't get that on the free. I don't need a software recommendation. Quality software download, I don't even know what that means. And remote management, I don't need that. So it looked like the free version of the program would do everything that I actually needed to do. Next. So when you download it, it's a pretty rudimentary program, and it's a very old-style looking program. But you run it, and it will come up, and it'll just say, okay, you, in my case, you have 4 updates available, and you can rescan if you do repair some things rather than restarting the program. You can have it rescan and just it will tell you what's up to date then. And if you click on read more, next, it'll load up a list of the programs that are on your system that they know there is a more recent version available. Next. One of the problems is that some of these updates, I don't know if it's a security update, but I know some of them are not free. So Snagit I use on my computer, and I have version, what is it, I've got installed version is version 22. So that's 2022 is the version, as Snagit calls it, and version 2024 is actually on the market now. So I'm 2 years out of date on it. That's fine on a program that I'm paying for. I don't really care. Now, if there were security updates, you know, that I care about, but I don't know. And TextPad is another one where I have version 7, and it is not a free upgrade to version 8. And so, you know, I don't know if there is a security problem on those particular programs or not. Next. So I'd like to know, you know, what are other people using for vulnerability management on their system, and do you find it any good? Do you find any problems with it? Do you, you know, are you happy with it? Are you paying for it? Is it a freebie? I'd really like to know what other people have. And I see Timothy saying, doesn't Glarisoft also have a registry cleaner? I will not use a registry cleaner on any of my computers. Microsoft and yes, well documented that registry cleaners often cause problems on Windows computer, and they very, very rarely actually fix problems on Windows computers. And that includes people like Mark Rusinovich, who was the first person to reverse engineer the NTFS file system, and very, very smart guy. He's the chief technology officer of Azure at Microsoft now. And he says, yeah, don't use registry cleaners. They cause more problems than they fix. So I see Tom saying he's using OPatch or ZeroPatch. SpyBot Search and Destroy, it actually has the ability to tell you if your programs are out of date.
And oh, I'm sorry, it doesn't do anything. You asked about vulnerability management, and there are various vulnerabilities, not just obsolete programs. So I included SpyBot Search and Destroy and Hitman Pro.
Yeah.
They're both good programs. They're free. You basically, for a lot of the virus checkers, you pay for real-time detection. But if you just want them to scan files or to scan your whole computer manually, the free version does a good job. And that's what SpyBot Search and Destroy and Hitman Pro, that's what I use them for.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So we can move on because I don't think we want to belabor issues here. But if anybody is looking for vulnerability management, by all means, I think Larisoft it's doing a good job. I would like really a true vulnerability management rather than an update management program. But in the absence of having a free vulnerability management program, Glarisoft certainly seems to do a decent job of update management. So if anybody else has any ideas on that, throw it into the chat, and maybe if we get a bunch of suggestions or something like that, I'll do up a couple of slides for a future Q&A. And with that, let's move on.
Okay, thanks there, Chris. So next up, we have another issue on speeding up old computers, and the second comment here from a friend, my Windows laptop is so slow, really slow, and how can we fix that? Well, my friend went away for a few weeks and left her computer with me, so I got all kinds of time to actually play with it and try and figure out what was wrong. And thanks very much to my colleague Chris for the graphics here. My colleague Chris and Bing, yes. So slow in my friend's case meant really, really slow. I did some tests on boot up, and typically it was taking a minute and a half to boot up, anything from 33 seconds to a couple of minutes. And shutdown was even worse. It was taking 2 minutes on average to shut down, and the worst case I had, it took over 4 minutes just to shut Windows down, which is crazy. And then the other thing, I did a Windows update on it, and it got stuck at 44% and just sat there forever and ever and ever. And I just let it run overnight, and sometime or other it must have finished. But it really did get stuck. And disk cleanup saw 12 gig of free space on the disk, or space on the disk it could clean up, but it wouldn't actually clean up. So I figured something was wrong, and I tried that PC manager, but it didn't really help. But you remember also that Chris had done a presentation on Windows Tune-Up, and a couple of things that he mentioned were looking for items that were hogging the CPU or hogging the disk. And the way to look for that is to go to Task Manager and run performance checks. So I did that. I ran Task Manager on this machine, and I looked at the disk, and I could see the disk was active, even when the CPU wasn't really doing very much. So I wasn't exactly sure what was going on there. And now Chris also suggested a program called HDD Scan. And this is a free program. It will run a smart report. So most modern disks have this smart technology built in. So it will tell you how the kind of health of the drive, I guess, in a whole bunch of categories. But the other thing that this HDD scan does is it runs tests, and it will report things like access speed from various blocks on the drive. It will give you processing times, and it will show you processing times which exceed a particular threshold. So I didn't actually think to make screenshots of my tests on this actual machine. So you just have to deal with some examples I've got from different technologies. So here's a smart report from a solid state drive. And you can basically see it kind of passes with flying colors. I think everything in the left-hand column there is green, which green is for good, I guess. And Bill's asking, does it work on SSDs? Yes, it does, because that is a report from my SSD. So the other thing that you get is you get a graph of access speed, essentially, kilobytes per second, I think it is. And you can see that this is somewhat variable. I think the bad news is if the number's high, because that means it's taking a lot. No, wait a minute. You get kilobytes per second. So you're getting lots of kilobytes per second. So it's the bottom. When it's low, it's not so good, because you're not getting very many kilobytes in a given second. So it's being slow to process the various blocks. And I'm not sure what I would do with this disk. It's all over the map. It's kind of bad early on, and then it gets really flaky or not flaky, how you look at it. This map down here is quite useful. It basically scrolls up as the program scans the various blocks on the disk, and then it color codes them if things are bad. So you can see here I've got some a dark gray one, which means it's taking longer to access that block than it is to access the rest. And you can also see this thing as a report. And here's a report, and Tom warned me a few weeks ago about SD cards. And here's a report on an SD card, and you can see it didn't like a whole bunch of stuff. Bad blocks, whatever it all means. But these are the results for my friend's laptop computer, and basically has lots of black lines all over that graph for the whole thing. So a lot of it was good and a lot of it was bad, and some of it was really bad. When I looked at the map, I had lots of green, which in this case isn't so great, and lots of red, which is definitely bad. And when I looked at the report, some processing times for individual blocks were more than 1,000 milliseconds. So it took more than a second to process a single block, which suggests that's not so good. And if you remember the discussion that led to using HDD scan, Chris had said that maybe what was happening was the disk was failing, and the disk controller tried to read from the disk, the read failed, and then it tried again, and it kept retrying, which is why everything was taking forever. One of the other things you can do is actually download the software that belongs to your hard drive. And in this case, it was a Seagate drive. So I downloaded this utility called CTools, ran the checks on it, and it basically failed. And then when I went back to Task Manager and ran the performance tests again, now I'm seeing the disk sitting at 100% all the time, and the CPU is hardly doing anything. So that tends to support Chris's thesis that the disk was failing and not actually completing the reading process correctly. So what's the solution? Well, my solution is basically rip out the hard drive and put in a solid state. So here we're looking at the base, the bottom of the laptop computer. You can see I've taken three screws out and taken off this odd-shaped plastic panel. These things over here are the random access memory cards, and this is the spinning hard drive in a carrier. You basically slide this out from the SATA connection here, and then lift it out. There are four screws in the side, which you take out, and you've got the carrier available. You plug in the solid-state drive. So the answer is seven screws, $40 cash, and you can install a 250-gig solid-state drive instead of the spinning hard drive. So my friend is elated. We've gone from a minute or so to boot up down to 12 seconds. And instead of a 2-minute shutdown, it now shuts down in 7 seconds. So if you're still running a spinning drive and you're having any problems, solid state drives are really cheap and they're very easy to install in computers. So it's well worth a look. Okay. Anything on that, Chris, in the chat?
No, there is some recommendations on MyDefrag and some other defragging tools and so forth. In this case, I don't think it was a defrag that was needed on it. It really was a failing hard drive, and replacing the hard drive was the solution.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks very much. Okay. So next up, we have a loony bit from Tom. Loony Bits are Canadian websites that people might find interesting. And Tom, you want to talk about this one?
Sure. Simon D'Entremont is a Nova Scotia photographer. He does a lot of nature photography, but he's also doing other stuff. He has a YouTube channel, which is at Simon D'Entremont. I think the link is there. And he also has a website. The website has a gallery of all his pictures and other information, the stuff he uses and so on. But I think I found him through YouTube, and he has some really good presentations. He gets into the details. I agree with everything he says, which is surprising. And he has a really good presentation. He's a very good presenter. He keeps to the subject matter, and he is very good at what he does, not only at presenting, but also on the stuff that he is presenting. It's accurate. It's well placed. The videos are all about, as usual, it's about 10 minutes or so. And I recommend that you look through his videos, and if there's anything you want to check them on or that you want to learn about, then try looking at some of his 77 videos. He's a really great photographer, a great digital photographer.
Okay, thanks, Tom. And both links are there, actually. The first link is the website, and the second link is his YouTube channel. And I think they're both in the chat. Okay, so moving along, we had a question came in from Lise, and she has switched to the dark side. She's gone from a Microsoft PC to a MacBook, and she wanted to know what happens to her email and phone contacts. And not knowing anything about Microsoft Outlook, on the web it says that it really depends which version of Outlook you use, how you actually export the contacts. But essentially you can export the contacts in, at least in one case, to a CSV file. But it depends which Outlook you're using, the new one or the old one. I've got no idea which is the new one or the old one. And if anybody has any better information than that, then put something in the chat and we'll come back to it later on. But essentially, if you've got contacts on your device, you should be able to export them. And CSV files are useful because you can pull that into Excel and basically use it as though it was text.
A lot of people, I'd say probably most people, use webmail, either Gmail or Outlook or whatever, and they have all the mail on the web, and it shouldn't be any different on a Mac as it is on a PC. Minor formatting differences, but it should be the same. If she can export, if she does have an email program, then if it's Thunderbird runs on Mac, Linux, and Windows, and that would solve her problem. Or if you can export from her current program to Thunderbird, then you can do that and then bring everything over to the Mac. Otherwise, there shouldn't be any problems as far as I can see.
Okay, thanks, Tom.
Thank you. Sorry.
Oh, that's no problem.
Is that Lise?
Yes.
Oh,
I
welcome
just
aboard.
Thank you. But I don't, this is all over my head, so, but I'm listening and trying to learn, and thank you for mentioning my problem.
Well, if you look,
well, it's not exactly a problem.
If you're using Outlook and you look at this link down here, there's quite a lot of information in that in terms of how to export the contacts.
Okay. Tiny Earl.
And that's been pasted into the chat window as well. You can pick up the URL there.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Okay, you're welcome. All right, so moving along, I've got a share here on a poor man's network attack storage system, I guess. And I think this comes back, oh, this is 2021, I talked about this, trying to put a micro USB drive into the back of the USB port on my Dell No, it was a tech-savvy router at the time, I think, which was a using the Rogers backbone. Anyway, it was a tech-savvy router. I could find the IP address for the thing, and by using this run app, I could give it the IP address and then assign a, I was supposed to assign a drive letter. But the problem was I got an error message and it said, you can't connect to the share because it's not secure. And it needed Samba 2, and this router only supported Samba 1. And so this was going nowhere. However, I've now upgraded to Bell 5. I've got a brand new GigaHub router. And when I go on to Bell's website or search in Google to find out how to connect up a USB device, then it gives me this list of instructions, which basically says, connect to this / my network, which would be great, except when I follow those instructions, I plug my micro USB card drive into the router, run the instructions, and it tells me that, well, this my network isn't available. So more Google searching finds another way to do this, and it tells me to use the run app and put in the IP address, which now I think about it, that's what I was trying to do 2 years ago, but I'd forgotten those instructions. Anyway, sure enough, if you find the run app using the search box, then plug in the IP address, then you get a network share. Or at least that's the theory. So the question is, we've got two sets of instructions, and how do I make the thing work? And the obvious answer is to consult the networking guru, and you have to ask Chris, what is going on, Chris? And he says, well, maybe it's something to do with DNS and how the router's IP address is set up, and if you're using a secondary DNS device like Quad9 or something, then maybe it can't get to it. But essentially, I had the thing set for auto, and I wasn't actually doing anything special. And then the second thing he said to me was, well, you can just map the drive letter using a command prompt. So we know the share name, we've got the IP address, so we just give it this command, and lo and behold, Windows will set up the network share. Except it didn't, and I got no idea why it wouldn't do that. But remember that run command? If I use the run command and plug in the actual IP address, which is exactly the same thing as you would get if you use the command, so why the command doesn't work, I don't know. But when I do that, I put the share, I can right-click on the share, and the context menu here allows me to map the network drive. So I map the network drive to drive Z. I tell it that I want to reconnect this drive every time I sign on. So now I have my USB 64 gigabit USB drive available to me as drive Z anytime I open up Windows. And sure enough, here is the network share in File Explorer, and I check that, yes, I can upload files to that share, and I can download files from that share. So I now have admittedly relatively small 64 gig drive, which will work as network attached storage, which I can access from any computer that's connected to my local area network. So it's going to be a really handy little device for swapping files around between my laptop and my desktop and my phone.
Bill asked why you would want to connect the USB drive to your router, and I guess you just covered that, the idea that you then have storage that is accessible from any device that's on your network. So it makes it easy to share files amongst multiple computers within your house.
Yeah, you could also share drives that are on your PC as well, so that you could access them from other computers.
And then I could open them up to the rest of the world, right?
Well, no, but the thing is that then you have to have that computer on all the time. This way, the router is always on. And so by having it on the router, then you could shut down any computer and the files are still accessible by any other computer that happens to be on the network. That's what I find.
I could put a bigger drive in there as well if I wanted to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but the idea of having, you know, it always available because the router is always turned on, that any device that happens to be on the network can access that storage is really, really nice. So I think if you have multiple computers in your house, going through this and struggling a little bit maybe to get it working properly, you could find it to be really, really useful for sharing files amongst computers.
Okay, so the other thing I have is a little glitch, well, not really a glitch, an annoyance I found with the Opera web browser. I don't use Opera very much because I typically use Vivaldi, which is a kind of a fork of Opera. But the trouble with Vivaldi is when I run the CBC Listen app, it only plays one track and then it stops, whereas Opera keeps going the whole time. But the problem is they've just upgraded Opera. And now they have, when you load up Opera, it loads this graphic here and plays this kind of booming sound on the speakers, which, I mean, it's short-lived, but I still find it very annoying. So again, Mr. Google knows how to get rid of this kind of stuff. So basically what you do is when Opera loads, you go into the address bar and you type opera:// flags, and that brings up a search box, and you type intro because you're looking for introduction. And then when you get the introduction, you set the status for disabled. So here we've got Opera loaded. There's the Opera flags command. It loads this experiments system. I search for intro. It finds Opera One introduction. And I basically disable the sound. And now Opera loads completely quietly. And life is now wonderful once again. Okay, moving along. We are inside the last 10 minutes, only just, which is good. So our timing is good for once. So if anybody has any other questions, comments on anything we've talked about, things that you would like to share right now, now's the time to open your microphone, tell us all about it, or put something in the chat. So Bob Harris says he uses Opera at times and he gets the annoying intro. So I guess, Bob, now you know how to fix it.
I don't see anything else that has come up in there. There were a couple of other comments about the sharing of a device and that. And Tristan said could also create a desktop shortcut with the path to the USB drive. There'd be another option on there. Something new. Oh, Tristan just posted worst passwords of 2023. Hope nobody here is using them. I've been giving presentations at the Ottawa Public Library. Today was one on managing all your passwords, and yeah, certainly avoiding the worst passwords is a good idea. You can be
careful. The big question there, Chris, is this password, is that still number one?
Probably, yeah. I wouldn't be all surprised. Either that or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, because people know that that's so much more secure than 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So, yeah. No, number one. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So no. they haven't caught on to the fact that if you go to 7, 8, you're much better off. I'm being facetious if anybody takes me seriously on that. Yeah, good password management is definitely worthwhile. Tom pasted in a thing about defragment hard disks with My Defrag. Make sure you don't, well, they probably won't actually do it anyways, but don't try to defrag an SSD. Solid state drives do not need defragging. They can access any part of the drive as fast as any other part. And if you do manage to actually defrag it, you're just going to be shortening the life of the SSD because it's just going to be using up some of the write cycles on the memory cells.
Actually, it may. Defragging isn't going to speed it up much because even though you've got a million fragments, you can get to them very quickly.
Yeah.
There is a something that happens with SSDs, and that's when they are well used, and one area is well used for read-only for ages and ages and ages, which, of course, is your OS and your boot files, and they don't get changed. And the story, the charge that is stored that says whether it's zero or one slowly deteriorates, and the software that's actually in the SSD can correct for these issues by repeatedly taking a look at them, but it doesn't refresh them. So one thing you can do to make an SSD fast again is to refresh that area. There's a program called SpinWrite that does that. There's also HD Sentinel, which will do that. Unfortunately, they aren't smart enough to just refresh the slow portions. They refresh the whole drive, which, of course, leads to extra writes. But SSDs can get slow, but they do it because they lose charge.
That's interesting. I never thought of that. That's, yeah, that's interesting effect of SSDs, yeah.
I just wanted to say, I don't remember where I read this, but it was either somebody sent an email or I read it like on ZDNet. The portable SSDs should be charged or plugged in once in a while because otherwise they lose the power, which I didn't realize that. I thought they were handled like the old jump drives.
Interesting. Yeah, I'd never heard of that. That's interesting. Yeah, cool. Okay, I don't see anything else in the chat. So, Alan, do you have some wrap-up slides? Or
I just got to think I've only got one, actually.
Okay.
I've only got one, right. So,
okay.
Yeah, so we basically have a clean slate, I think, for next week. And so if you have any questions that are burning a hole in your brain, send them along and we'll try to find an answer for you. And especially if you have interesting topics to share or your favorite applications that we don't know about, we always like to hear about new things. So, as always, send in the details of what you have to suggestion box at opcug.ca. There's always a couple of people hanging on every word that comes into that inbox.
Okay. Thanks, folks. Right. We'll
hope everybody found tonight interesting. And thanks, everyone, for the contributions. And we'll see you next week.
Cheers.
Don't forget, the following Friday, it's Black Friday. So start looking for those. So start looking for those computers or parts deals.
Yeah.